My name is Father Mike. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I'm a recovering atheist. So there you go. Those of you who can identify with that. It's so humbling to be here before this group. This is just such an awesome group that you've got here. I just give you so much credit. It's just terrific. It's very old school, old-time AA. I've been clean and dry since June 18 of 1977 by the grace of God and the power of His Spirit working through AA. And, boy, you know, speaker meetings were the bread and butter of AA at that time when you're new. That's for most of the meetings. And they made a great impression on me. They were part of how I came to accept and recognize being an alcoholic. I showed up at my first AA meeting following a good-looking woman into the meeting. I wasn't looking for sobriety. I was looking for, you know, something else. And just saying. And so it was hearing people give their witness, you know, getting to really hear the stories that brought me around. And, you know, that's how they did 12-stepping. If you look at Bill and Bob in A Vision for You, or they tell a story of on a 12-step call, Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, you can see accompanying it, there is always this thing of telling people, and that made a great impression. The other guy would hear them and say, wow, you know about what it is to be a drunk. You've got my attention. And this is what happened to me. And they used to say in old-time AA, you know, identify with the feelings, with the thinking, maybe not the particular drinking behavior. Who cares if you were getting drunk on vodka and I was knocking back Jim Beam? Don't worry about that. Well, I just drank beer. Well, you might belong too, so just have a seat and stay in there, you know. But what is the thinking that's going on? What's the feeling? What are some of the other behavior patterns in relationship along with the drinking, whatever it is? And this helped me identify myself. I was born and raised in New York City. I was raised Roman Catholic. I loved the church as a kid. I think even as a kid, you know, I had yearnings for the priesthood and stuff. And I soon buried them because my father hated priests. And so you're not going to go for something that your dad hates. And so I think that probably was a significant screw-up inside of me early on in life. The thing that I thought I wanted most and maybe God wanted me to do, my dad hated. My dad was very important to me. I wasn't as important to him, but he was very important to me. And I grew up in a house in circumstances that looked very blessed from the outside. I don't realize that until once in a while I'm telling somebody about when I was a kid and I'm looking at their looking back at me and I'm going like, oh, I guess that really is, you know, talking about my French tutor and my fencing coach who was one-on-one, former captain of the Hungarian cavalry, Andy, teaching me saber and going to school in Switzerland and rooming with Charlie Chaplin's kid. She's a funny kid. He had this tooth that came out, you know, and they're looking at me and it's like, oh, yeah, that's the kind of life I had. And, you know, we went to Bermuda or San Juan or Florida on all our vacations. And the pictures of me as a little kid with the white jacket and the black tie and the cummerbund and, you know, just looked great. And it wasn't great. It was not great. I don't know what was going on. I think my mother was mentally ill. I think she might have been borderline personality disorder. My brother, I had something really wrong with him. I was on a date once with a lady and just chatting about our childhood. And in the middle of dinner, she said, so was your brother ever diagnosed psychopathic? And I went like... choking on the albondiga soup, you know, like, what? She said, well, I didn't tell her, like he was a serial killer or something. And she said, well, no. She said, would you say he was capable of loving and receiving love? And the fact that I didn't have a ready answer for her, I guess, gave it away. You know what I mean? He tried to kill me twice as a child. I don't know if some of you, maybe not the women, but guys know guys, they don't have that governor on them. There's something that pulls you back when you're wrestling with the other guy. And then there are a few guys you'll meet in life, they don't get it. They're hitting after the whistle is gone, and they're not stopping until the coaches pull them off. It's like there's something wrong with the guy. That was my brother. He was a very angry guy, and he didn't know, you know. And my parents never dealt with it. And so, you know, we talk about this disease as physical, mental, and spiritual. And the disease starts up before the actual drinking. They always said that in AA. I was an alcoholic long before I picked up my first drink. Many people will say that. But often we don't really explain that. You know, we go into our drunk-along. So I want to try to explain a little bit of what that means, what was going on. My life was unmanageable before I started drinking, and it was the unmanageability that pushed me towards the drinking. That's the way it worked. I didn't have a perfect life till I started knocking back a bottle of scotch a day. You know, that's not what happened. Something was very wrong with me and my life that needed help. And as a little boy, and I'm going to tell you stuff about my life. I didn't know this my first year sober. It's taken years for stuff to be revealed to me. Stuff has been buried. Some of the worst things are just didn't come to me until 10 years sober. And so it's going to sound like, oh, you had this. And I know, it's taken me a long time to have this revealed to me. So as a child, I realized I was sexually assaulted on 3 different occasions before the time of, before the 4th grade. That's going to change a person. And I buried all of that. I was the kind of person who, by the time I was in my early 20s, even though I was having success in certain areas, I knew there was something wrong with me. Something is friggin' wrong with me. What is wrong with you, Michael? And I should have been asking myself, Michael, what happened to you? I had the wrong question. If you don't have the right question, nothing's going to happen. If only someone had said, stop doing that to yourself. That's called shaming. Where was John Bradshaw when I needed him, you know? It's like, he wasn't there. I was just shaming. And I needed someone to say, hey, it's not about, what happened to you, Mikey? What was going on there? A lot of stuff happened. By the time I was 7 years old, I said wrote a running away from home note. But what I put in it was kind of different. I said, I'm leaving this madhouse. And my mother thought that was so cute. They were crazy. I realized the people in charge of my life were crazy. My mother and brother were violent, incredible. And my brother was violent with me. And my father couldn't stand it, so he just worked and made a lot of money. He was very good at it. He was a nice guy, but he was emotionally incapable of fathering and husbanding us kids and that woman. It wasn't going to happen. And so I was left, and that's when I gave up on God. I didn't say I'm giving up on God. I still love God and go to church. But that's where I thought, I've got to do something. No one's looking out for me. No one's taking care of me. I tell my mom about how my brother's beating me up, and she told me, go on, you love it. This is a woman who took me to the emergency room the day my brother attacked me in the head with a golf club. That was one of the 2 times he tried to kill me. This isn't, oh yeah, boys wrestling on the floor. Thank you very much, no. The other time I was in 5th grade, he tried to strangle me, and the maid pulled him off. She's one of these maids that gives birth to linebackers, you know. God bless Henrietta, you know. Henrietta, she pulled Dennis off. Dennis, get off him! And, you know, it's all funny when you're looking through the rearview mirror, right? But boy, and so I was like, I was scared. And so this kind of left alone in a frightening world, I've got to do something. I did a couple of things. I started getting lost in my head. I'd go to bed early just so I could close my eyes and go into dreamland. Just start dreaming. And once in a while, I got drunk. My first drunk was in the 2nd grade. And my mother realized it and sent me in. It was my first showing up for life with a hangover, being a functional alcoholic, you know. By the time I was in 8th grade, something bad happened, for me anyway. It's not... I was so eager for my father's love and attention. I was like, please. And he never gave it. And in the eighth grade, I sort of hit a high water mark. I excelled academically. I was valedictorian getting out of eighth grade. I had made it into the two most prestigious high schools in America. In America. Only through competitive exam. I could go to either one. And I also made it onto the all-star team of the baseball game that was played between faculty and students. I was starting first baseman. It's like, wow. No one showed up for the game. Okay? No one. You know, I'm a father now. I have a son and a daughter. If my son was starting first baseman on the friggin' All-Star, I'd be there with 10 or 20 of you. Are you kidding me? We're going. Nobody. And I'll tell you the killer in it. I don't remember being upset at the time. See, I was so used to it by then. It's just like, it's only years later that I look back and I'm a dad and I go, what the hell was that about? Whoa, because now I'm a dad. You know what I'm saying? So it took me years to catch up to, like, wow, you are already dead to it. Then, on top of it, I'm doing all this thing, like, love me, notice me, please. My brother tells me behind my back, he said, yeah, Dad thinks you're a faggot. You know that, don't you? And I never checked it out with Dad, you know. And I just went, something inside me just went, I don't know. It's a bad word, but something inside me went, fuck it. Fuck this. And I went into, I started doing dissociating. I went through high school, I don't know, my emotionally as a zombie. I think my dissociating and smoking cigarettes killed enough stuff. But by senior year, I needed more. So I started drinking and smoking dope. And I managed to get out. And somewhere in high school, in our school, you had to have honors to go into drama. I started acting. I was freaking brilliant at acting. It was like, wow, I'm getting so much attention. I'm like standing ovations. It's like, oh my God, women are crazy for me. It's like, wow, this is like, and I turned my will and my life over to theater. It became my higher power. Because it brought me, what are the two things we want to get that we get from liquor? The ease and comfort. You know, it was giving me emotional, like, I'm wanted. I'm being paid attention to. People like, I'm going with this. And, of course, with the art crowd came smoking dope and drinking. Yeah. And so I'm on board with that. And I got this girlfriend. You're going to be on internet. I'm going to make up names. I have this, not a real name, but Barb, okay? I'll call her Barbara. Barbara is a downtown girl. Yeah, her mom is divorced. They just live together. They got all these artsy friends and that. I'm in the Bronx, six blocks from Yankee Stadium. I don't know what's shaking, but she knows everything. And she's a year older than me. Very dangerous. Very dangerous. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, you older women, you get that young guy. It's like, wow. Oh, she had me shaking, man. And she's like, she's pushing the edge. She's reading these wild books and read this. It's like, oh, wow, yeah, that's amazing. And, you know, one of these books, this author says, dare to be yourself. This free love, free speech, whatever, dude, Andre Gide, turn of the century, it's like, dare to be yourself. She says, what do you say? And I say, we're going to do that. I'm going to dare to be myself, yeah. It's like, right. And I tell people, I said, you know, that may not be the worst thing in the world. That's okay advice. I said, you know, but not to an alcoholic. You know why it's bad for us? We don't know who we are. We haven't settled down there. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. See, I never get my emotional needs met. I had to become this sort of hand puppet, Michael, I created to get the attention. I found that in theater. It's like, oh, this they like? Oh, this works. This gets attention, love. Oh, I guess we'll do more of that. And I didn't realize I was abandoning myself. Michael, I don't know how Michael was. I was this thing that pseudo-Michael. I don't know what. Try my best. So dare to be yourself. What the hell did that mean to me? I just got more lost. I moved out of the house. I started going to college in New York City. I was living alone. I started drinking on a daily basis. Inside of 6 months, I had a complete mental alcoholic breakdown. I just drank myself silly. I was an alcoholic before 18. I used to drink and go out to school, and I wouldn't wind up in school. I went into a blackout. I wound up in the Museum of Modern Art in the Water Lilies room looking at the paintings. I mean, this happened half a dozen times. Same room, Museum of Modern Art, there I am. Now, this is, among other things, the crazy part. This is why you know you're an alcoholic. See, I come in there, and I thought I was going to be at school, and here I am staring at this painting. What is my reaction? Wow, I love this painting. See, you're all sick alcoholics like me, and you don't blink at me saying that. If you were normal people, you would say, that's no reaction. It should be, what the hell am I doing here in a museum? Why, what, where did I get to? But all of you, you're just sitting there like, yeah, I bet you saw the painting. You thought it was nice. Right? Did you see how none of you reacted to me going, yeah, I was like, yeah, he liked the painting. You're all crazy. You should be upset that I wind up someplace in a blackout and I don't know how I got there. When I was 13, when I turned 13, I was sneaking drinks during my birthday party at home. I went into a blackout, and I passed out at the dinner table. And I got up in the middle of the night, I threw up, I went to the kitchen, I got the birthday cake I hadn't had, pulled out my school books, and did my work. Then I went back for another hour of sleep, got up, and went on with it. At 13, I learned how to be a functioning alcoholic. And I'm bringing this up now because of non-reaction. No one in my family said, Michael, what happened last night? What was going on there, passing out at the table at your birthday dinner? No one said anything. This is part of my disease, denial. So here I am, daring to be myself at 17 with Barbara. At 26, this is no lie, this is the truth of it, at 26 years of age, I'm literally on my knees with my sponsor. We're at his bed. That was old school. You go to your sponsor's bedroom because the bed hit just about the right size for kneeling. That's how you did it. Big book in front of us, and I'm saying the third step prayer. I'm getting a little choked up, asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self. This self, I was so hopped up into daring to be at 17, now was a thing that was freaking killing me, that I was bound by. And I'm saying, God, take this thing, this self. I don't want to celebrate myself, man. I don't want to do it, man. It's just like, I don't want to dare to be this. I don't want it. And it says in the big book, beautifully, that we get to the point where we want to let God tell us what he would have us be. That's what I needed. I needed to be told who I am and what to be. That's what I needed, because my way didn't work. I had success. I had tremendous success for my age. At 22, I finished my undergraduate degree. I went to New York. I started a theater company on my own. I was 22. I created a form of theater people hadn't seen before. It got tremendous reviews. A visiting scholar from Germany videotaped it, included it in the curriculum at the Institute of American Affairs in Berlin. I'm 22 years old. What do you think I did when that happened? Did someone say you drank? I hope that's what you said. I not only drank, I ran away from New York for a hookup on the coast. That didn't work out. I can't handle that. Just screw it all up. Isn't that what it says in the book? At just the wrong time, guy sealing the deal in Washington, D.C., or the guy with the auto parts, or you name it, at perfect timing, screw it up. Here's to all of us who screw it up, you know? I couldn't take it. And part of what was not knowing who I am, not being grounded. And so my spiritual problem began early on in childhood, but now the mental and physical part come. I was going crazy. At the end of my drinking in particular, I was going crazy. I was crazy for a long time, but don't forget, I'm a child of the 60s, and being crazy was good. R.D. Lang had influenced psychiatry. You say, who's to say crazy is crazy? Maybe the rest of you are crazy. A Swedish psychologist came out with a report that said, given the way modern world is, anyone who can live in this world and not be neurotic is really crazy. That's like people who look beautiful under fluorescent lights, you know. They're probably aliens, you know. It's like, no one looks good. So that was like just like, yeah, we're crazy. Of course we're crazy. We're normal. We're crazy. Go on. Keep drinking. Let's go. And I had people around me. I lived la vie boheme. I wasn't going to a corporate job. So my drinking never stood out against everyone else's. I created this life, this crazy life around me. And the more I succeeded, the worse I felt. And I started feeling alienated from human beings. I remember in February of 77 feeling like something up inside me up and died. I was becoming cynical, and I thought, well, you've just lost your innocence. That's all. I didn't realize, no, you're becoming spiritually very sick. I was losing a sense of connectedness to other human beings. I could see stories on the news, which should be very moving and upsetting. I think I could care less. And I had enough consciousness to say that there's something wrong there. But I didn't know what to do about it. And I knew the next martini would make the feeling or thought go away. When we come into AA, you hear people saying, how am I doing on the time? How much time do I have left? Don't worry about it. He's in control. So that's pretty scary right there. So thank you. Because I want to give time to recover, you know, not just give like drunkalogue and then 2 minutes of recovery. Here's what's happening at the end of my drink. I talked about the spiritual malady started early. The minute I'm living a life by self-will, which I started to do as a child, I thought I had to depend on me, there's a spiritual malady right there. The mental part, what is insanity according to the big book? Well, pretty much it's you don't see things in proper proportion, and you're not thinking straight. So things that seem really important to us are relatively unimportant. And then there are really important things we could care less about. It's just all that. So if I'm interested in you, who you're sleeping with, is hugely important to me. I mean, I'll be going through your underwear, your mail, your phone messages. That's like, oh, got to find out. That's really important. Now, the fact that I'm pissing brown on a daily basis, it's like, whatever. Yeah, no, not a big deal. I think I've probably too much coffee. Yeah, too much coffee. Yeah. I keep seeing mice in the apartment, in the side of my eye. You know, the little bastards, they never show up right in front, you know? They're just doing this. You know. And so, that's not important. That's not. Well, I'm living in the East Village. There probably are mice there. What am I going to do? Me and a loose feeling in my fingers and toes. I'm 26 years old. Oh, that's not important. That's just a cigarette. I'll cut back on the cigarettes. Are you hearing what I'm saying? This is insanity. My thinking, I'm lack of proportion. I'm not taking things seriously, which I should, and other things are crowding it out and obsessing about. That's the insanity of the disease. And with that comes now the physical. So we did spiritual, mental, the physical. You're hearing the physical symptoms that cannot be denied. That cannot be denied unless you're me and can say, that's from too much coffee and cigarettes. That's probably from, I can't sleep on my right side, which is where my liver is. Am I right? We have an RN here. Will you confirm that for me? Liver is on this side. So that's kind of sore now. You know what I'm saying? But that's from too much exercise. I figure, nurse, those are my intercostal muscles. I looked it up. Oh, intercostal muscles. That's what it is. Sure. You know what I'm saying? I'm hearing the phone ringing while I'm taking a shower and running out to answer it. You know, My central nervous system is falling apart. I'm having auditory DTs going to bed at night. I'm hearing these amen choruses. I realized later it was the air conditioning unit outside my window. And so when the mind, the alcoholic body is breaking down, so it interprets sounds and it comes out in some weird way. You know, but I had excuses for all of this stuff. That was all physical. And one thing I did know was that life wasn't working for me because I was suicidal. I was achieving the things that were going to make me happy. I was getting write-ups. Now I was 26. While I'm going to school, I'm getting a graduate degree at a very prestigious school in theater directing. I wound up winning the award at the end of the year, number one. I had previously gotten a grant to continue my studies. I got a grant with a cash prize at the end for being so brilliant. While I'm still in school, I'm already directing outside of school. I have my first TV directing job. You're my brothers and sisters. I'm not telling you this to impress you. I'm telling you, you know, so you understand the insanity that's going on here. That I thought that stuff was going to fix Michael. And so with all of this stuff going on, I'm suicidal. And that's where I'm hitting my bottom. That's where I hit my bottom. That's my bottom. It's like, I don't know. Self-reliance, fail. I took it as far as it could go. And it reminded me in a way of me with my dad. You know what? I'm valedictorian. I got into the high schools. I'm an all-star on the team. And it's like, you're a little faggot. It's like, I'm done, man. I lost faith in myself. I had a crisis of faith, not in God, in Michael. Michael had failed Michael. Now what you going to do? And I knew I was the smartest guy in the room. So it wasn't like Michael was going to go to you and say, why don't you run my life? You kidding me? My resume was better than yours. Why would I ask you? And so I was like, what? Now what? And I was an atheist, so God wasn't an option. I thought this lady would fix my life. I got to make up a name for her. What would be a good name? Because I don't want to give you a real name. I'll call her Laura, like the song. Laura, da-da-da-dee-da-dee-da-da. Okay, so I find out Laura has finally divorced her loser husband. I used to go to school with her years ago in college. She's free. And I'm thinking, you know what? I think we used to party a lot and do a lot. I never hooked up with her because she was so married and never liked that. We'd be cool about that. Now she's free. I start writing her, and it's like, yeah, come on out. She's in L.A. I'm thinking, okay. And I'm figuring Laura will fix my life. That's sort of behind my head. I also think I'm friggin' crazy, but I don't feel crazy enough to check into an insane asylum. Do you know what I mean? Because if they said you're crazy, what? And I have my resume. It's like you're paying your bills, you're winning awards, you just got that. You're not crazy. Get out of here. But I knew I was, you know. So I go see Laura. The first morning I see her, she has this huge plastic key ring that says "Let go, let God." And it's like, whoa, that's not what I remember Laura being into. This night. Laura and I used to hit the clubs in Hollywood and blah, 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 you know, and Wesson Oil parties and a lot of crazy stuff. So I'm just saying. And so now we got Let Go, Let God. And I'm like, oh, really? And turns out she's 5 months clean and dry in AA, working a great program, doing this, doing that. She's telling me her story, and I'm just like, wow. And of course, she looks so good. You know, you women, when you get sober and you clean it up and you're getting good and you're exercising, and she had this thing. I remembered her tonight because I got dressed to look really nice tonight. And usually I wear my clericals, but I didn't want to turn people off with the white collar and the thing. Last time I went out with that, my son says, yo, dog, you got your priest swag on. You know. I said, yeah, that's father dog to you. Yeah. Anyway, Rita used to say, I'd see her getting ready for the meetings. You know, you're beautiful. She's a beautiful woman. And she said, well, you kind of look good for the newcomer. Now, she wasn't looking the 13th step, then, mind you, I don't want to tell you that. But she said, hey, you know, I'm a representative of what this program and the power of God can do in my life. I want to show them. Because she remembered what it says in the third step, prayer. Right? At the end of it, the part they don't remember, right? That you're only asking God to do all this stuff so you can become a walking advertisement for what God can do in your life. So let's make ourselves look good. Isn't that great? So she's got me like, my God, what is this program? And then I tell people, she grew up in Colorado. She used to fish and hunt and everything. So she just played me like a rocky stream trout, you know? She's got that little fly out there and popping it, blah, 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 you know, trying to get this old speckled trout on the line there, you know. So she's saying, well, oh, you know, it just so happens it's time for one of those meetings. She was going to go to a noontime at Radford Street. And she said, well, you know, you can stay at the house. She had a house in Hollywood. She said, and, you know, she was right in Hollywood, so you could actually go walk and enjoy it. And I knew the area. She'd stay here, hang out in the neighborhood, and then she does that thing. Or, you know, if you want to go to one of those meetings with me. I was like, I want to go to the meeting. I didn't let her finish. She's like, yeah, I'm very interested. My story really falls flat here. It says, I got to Radford Street noon. I'm looking at the people there. I'm watching what's going down. I'm listening. As burnt out, nasty, cynical as I was, it just melted me. It melted me. I just looked and I said, I want what these people have. I want this. Something inside of me was not dead enough that I couldn't say, like, wow, what I see. I saw the joy of living. I saw people who had a peace that passed understanding, even though they're going through a divorce, even though this, if they're there, and they're giving their little two-minute pitches and talking about what happened and what it's like now. I'm hearing laughter, deep belly laugh, laughter. Laughter not at people, but with them, with sympathy, with an understanding. I'm seeing unconditional love in action. Some guy shares that he took a shot at his wife right before the meeting, swinging at her, comes into the meeting and he shares that. And he looks like, you know, he should have a tattoo on his forehead. I am bad news. You know, just that. That's who he is. And I'm thinking, this guy's bad news. What happens at the coffee break? He's got like half a dozen people around him. Not to throw him out. To help him. How are you? Here's my phone number. I'm like, what? And this one guy says, hi, I'm Frank. Here's my number. He said, look, I've got a couch. You can stay at my house tonight if you need to. I'll talk to your wife. And I'm thinking, this guy doesn't know this guy. He's telling him, I'm Frank. And he's inviting this guy, Mr. Bad News, 1977, into his house. And I just, something broke in me. My cynicism, my hatefulness, my resentment, something broke. And I went, these people are playing by different rules. And I wasn't so proud that he didn't realize, I wish I was in there with them. I want to be in the pool with these people. I want to be getting that love and be part of this. This is great. And that changed me. That meeting changed me. And you're going to die, man. I still didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just knew I wanted what these people had. But I kept going to meetings for a few days and started hearing all these stories. Remember I told you? And bit by bit, I hear a little of this, a little of that, and I'm like, oh, that, and that reminds me, and that's me, and that's me, and that's me. And finally on Sunday, on Saturday, June 17th, I'm hearing this God talk. Now I've got to tell you something. I'm an atheist, okay? But my atheism isn't working, and I know that. And Bill didn't want to hear that Ebby had gotten religion. But Bill said, was he interested? Of course I was interested, because I was hopeless. See, that's the big thing. If you're hopeless, the God talk ain't going to bother you an inch. Because I was an atheist, and it didn't bother me. It sounded like, whatever, man, bring it on. You got God? Fine. Let's try God. I tried everything else. Let's go. That was me, atheist. And so on Saturday afternoon, I'm walking in Griffith Park with Laura, and I look up in the sky, and I said, Lord, take me, in a kind of half-assed, kind of cynical, kind of wish it might be true, half-assed atheist prayer to God. The next day, I'm hearing a guy at Ohio Street, Sunday morning, best donuts in any AA meeting. Great. And he's telling my story. And I realize I'm an alcoholic. And the obsession to drink or use was lifted from me immediately. Immediately. Never's come back. Never. That's why I'm like 37 years sober now. It's not a false humility, like, oh no, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. That was God just took that from me. I didn't earn it. I swear, I mustn't ever, don't ever think I did. That just God did that. And so I went from being the world's most rebellious dude to, I decided quick. I thought, I recognize I have this problem. Sounds like AA has an answer here for me. It may not be the only answer, but it is the answer that works. Do you want to try it on your own? It's a bit of a crap roll. Or this looks like you do this, it's going to work. And, you know, I was never a great gambler, but I certainly didn't want to play when the stakes were my life. I wasn't willing to put that on the table and give it a shot on my own. I said, I want a sure thing. My dad would have said, you bet on the chalk horse, right? Yeah, that's right. But get on the one that's going to win. And so I decided to become AA Cub Scout of the Year. Tell me what to do. Tell me where to go. Tell me how to jump. Tell me how high to jump. Tell me where to jump. I love it. You're in charge. God's in charge. This program's in charge. I just did it. And I thought, I'm going to do it 100% for 30 days. And if I don't like how it's working, I will leave. It's not a cult. They're not going to grab me or whatever. But I said, if I do walk away from this, I need to know I did it. I did follow directions. These are exactly the way they said it. And I read the big book. I worked the steps with a step guide, some sponsor. I was of service. I never said no to an AA request. I prayed. I followed pages 86 through 88. I did it. And guess what happened after 30 days? My life was so much better. I mean, it was just incredible, the turnaround inside of Michael Nee. And I never looked back. I never wanted to drink or do it any other way. You know, I've had my ups and downs, needless to say, but it's just been incredible. The whole thing, that the God idea works. If you read We Agnostics, they tell you it's practical and reasonable. And, you know, people say, well, a leap of blind faith. They're saying, no, don't take a leap of blind faith. Listen to us. We're going to tell you what happened to us. Each one of us is a miracle. There's a lot of stuff we disagree on. But on one thing, we are absolutely in agreement, that each one of us have experienced a miracle of God, no matter how different. That's what the big book says. And all the personal stories tell people how they made their God connection. And I made my connection through AA. And I was told, I started praying to the God who had taken care of all of you. That's my first step toward praying to God. Whoever did that for them. Then something happened. I prayed to God for something that I needed. I needed a ride to an AA meeting. And in the middle of the meeting, at the coffee break, like you have a coffee break, some guy out of nowhere came up from behind me and he says, hey, can I give you a ride to a meeting on Thursday? Do you hear what I just said? I was praying in my head to God, and out of nowhere, this guy says, do you need a ride? And I'm like, wow. And then he says, I love to tell you this, he says, why don't we meet early? Because he knew the girl I was staying with. I know where she is. He said, do you ever had anything at Hamburg Hamlet? They make a good burger. I said, never been. He said, why don't I come early? I'll treat you to the hamburger, and then we'll go to the meeting. So I'm telling my sponsor about this, like, oh, my God. You know, it's like a guy had sex for the first time in his life. It's like, wow, you don't know how wonderful this is. You know, it's like, I think I know. It's okay, but tell me. Yeah. No, it's really special. It's like, I know. Tell me all about it. So I'm telling this God thing, and I said, not only did I get the ride, but God threw in dinner on top of it. What a God. And he told me something that was true, very important, and I share this wherever I go. He said, he was a beautiful man, very gentle with me. And he said, well, you know, Michael, this isn't the first time God has helped you in your life. And I went like, wow. He said, take some time tonight, go back and start thinking about places in your life where maybe God has been working in your life. He said, you already have a relationship with God. You just don't know it. And what I tell people is we work on having a conscious contact with God and improving that. But before that, we have had an unconscious contact with God. I had a lot of unconscious contact with God. I was just, and I started, and that became the God of my understanding. Because I looked at certain discrete moments in my life when I was about to die from an overdose of speed and liquor in San Francisco in 1972, and this still quiet voice kept saying, come on, Michael, you better wake up. Don't go to sleep. Don't go to sleep. You're going to forget to breathe if you go to sleep. Get up, get up, get up. And I didn't realize until years later this was God saving me. That plus a lot of other things. So I began more and more to have a resume of God in my life. That was a God of my understanding. And then I went back to the church of my childhood, the Catholic Church. God sent me a priest who asked me to be his sponsor. So I started sponsoring him, and I said, how about you spiritual direct me? He said, I'm down for it. Let's go. So we worked that. And then I moved out of the Catholic Church. I felt for a variety of reasons. I joined the Anglican Church, which is from the Church of England. And obviously the priests there get to marry, you know. I have a wife and I have a kid. And you know, my bishop knows I have a wife and kid, so it's all cool. And I was ordained in the year 2000. So, you know, and I had a life. I was in theater for 20 years directing, and then I got into real estate for 10 years. When the call came on me to serve God in this way, I just liquidated all my assets in New York, took my wife and little girl, and went to seminary. I mean, you know, I just said, well, isn't that what you do? That's what it says in the book that I read, you know. Drop it. Drop your nets, and let's go, buddy. Right, Leanne? Isn't that how it works? And so, you know, I've had my share of challenges in the meantime, and I've just found that I'm living life by spiritual principles. I got a couple of minutes, right? It's like, how does that come out today? That's really what it's about. And it's very, very simple, even though it's very profound. I still have these voices of temptation, you know. I'm losing my eyesight. I'm losing my hearing. I've got skin cancer. The medicine they want to give me for my eyes could make me impotent, okay? So this is all looking great. Don't you like this? It's like, But I feel joyous. I'm okay. And the guy is telling me, he's looking at me, he said, you need hearing aids. And I don't know what he saw in my face. He said, by the way, if you don't get a hearing aid, most people in your condition, they've been learning a lot. If they don't get the hearing aid, they fall a victim to dementia. And I still have that Robert De Niro thing, like, you talking to me? Hey, I'll get dementia. Fuck you and the horse you drove in. Yeah. I ain't getting no fucking hearing aid. Yeah. But, I mean, that little son of a gun is in there. But you know, he doesn't take over the show anymore. He doesn't take, because then I have like, yeah, I know, Bobby, just sit down and shut up, okay? We're getting hearing aids. You know, and then life goes on. And there's an attitude you bring to life. Look, I don't want to tell you I'm a saint, okay? But I have to tell you the victory God has in me. I do have some serious eye problems. I'm going to the Shiley Eye Clinic. I'm seeing this guy, Dr. Jeffrey Goldberg. This guy has a resume that's killer. When I go in there grateful to God that Dr. Goldberg, this guy is going to look at my eyes, and I'm going to get his undivided attention. I'm the luckiest guy in the world. And the other day they made a big mistake, and he shyly came to me and said, I'm so sorry, they didn't do this, we're going to have to retest you, can you do it another 20 minutes? And I told him, I said, I could be here 2 hours, I don't care, it's a privilege for me to come under your care. And he like practically blushed. He said, whoa, 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 thank you very much. Now we have, and a student doctor comes in with him. 20 years ago, you bring a student doctor and I say, get him out of here. I'm not here to teach. This kid comes in, when all the exam is done, I introduce myself, and my eyes are dilated, all of this stuff with the machine. I said, would you like to look at my eyes? And he looked at the doctor, he said, it's okay with him. I said, sure, why don't you take your best shot? And so I let him, you know what I'm saying? But I wasn't trying to be goody two-shoes. I've changed. God has changed me. And I look to be of service. This is not an alcoholic, but my, and I'm telling you, life is so much easier this way. Life is, it works. It just, you know, I'm so comfortable. I'm materially comfortable. I'm comfortable in my own skin. Wow. I know who I am today, you know, and I have real love in my heart, and I can receive love. And that's the greatest gift I've gotten. It's all come from God, but it happened to come through AA. And I needed the two of them in my life. Maybe you find it that way for you. Thank you very much.